Welcome to the talk. I'm Graham Hutton from University of Nottingham, and the subject of my talk today is how to be more productive, which is based on joint work with Mauro Vaskeliov, one of my former PhD students. If you're interested in getting a copy of the slides for the talk, or there's also a research paper on which everything is based, if you just do a Google search for my name, you can find everything on my webpage. You may be wondering about the picture here, so let me say a few words about this before we get going. So the picture shows an infinite sequence of beers, or an infinite stream of beers rather, coming out of a factory. And you can certainly be more productive by consuming fewer of these beers, but the talk is not about these, it's actually about the streams. So let's begin by refreshing our memory about what a stream actually is. So for the purposes of this talk, a stream is going to be an infinite sequence of values. So a sequence of values without end. So here's a very simple and a very familiar example of this. Here is the stream of natural numbers. So the natural numbers begin with 0, and then we have 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. And these go on forever. They're an infinite sequence or a stream. The notation which I'm going to use in this talk is that I'm going to separate successive elements of a stream by a little diamond symbol. And if you're reading along in the paper, you'll see that I use a different symbol in the paper. I use a little left-facing triangle, but that's simply because I couldn't find I use a diamond symbol here because I couldn't find the left-facing triangle in PowerPoint. Okay, so a stream is an infinite sequence of values, and we're going to use a little diamond symbol to separate successive elements. Let's think for a moment about the type of streams. So the type of streams in a language like Haskell can be defined something like this. Never mind the code part at the minute, let's just read this as a data type first of all. So the data type of streams whose values have type A is given by, you have a single value of type A followed by a stream of values of type A. So the first value here is called the head of the stream, and the remaining stream is called the tail. And the diamond symbol here is the constructor for streams. So what is the codata part in here? Well, this reflects the fact that streams are defined co-inductively rather than the more familiar inductive manner. And technically, this just means that streams arise as a greatest solution to their underlying equation rather than as a least solution. But this is something you don't really need to worry about. There's more kind of technical details about this kind of thing in the paper. The basic idea is a very simple one. Streams are an infinite sequence of values. How do you define streams? Well, streams have a very simple and natural definition using recursive equations. So here's a couple of examples of this. So here I'm defining a constant stream, the stream of ones. So let's read the definition and understand what it means. So I'm defining a stream called ones, and it has type stream of nat. So I'm assuming that I have some built-in type nat of natural numbers, 0, 1, 2, 3, etc. Then how do we define this constant stream of ones? Well, we have a simple recursive equation here. We say that ones is a single one followed by another stream of ones. Okay, so it's recursive. If you type this in to a suitable programming language, for example, Haskell, or in particular, the Glasgow Haskell compiler, you can run this thing and it will actually produce an infinite stream of ones. Here's a slightly more interesting example. Here's how to define the stream of natural numbers itself using a simple recursive equation. So the type is the same. Nats has type stream of natural numbers, but the definition this time is more interesting. So the stream of natural numbers is defined to be 0, that's the first natural number, followed by, and then what we do is we take the stream of natural numbers and we add 1 to every element of that stream using the map function, which we'll define in a moment, and plus 1 is just the successor function on natural numbers. It takes any natural number and adds 1 to it. So let's spend a minute and define this map operation. So How is this defined? Well, map, we take a function and we take a stream. So there's our function f and there's our stream. X is the head of the stream, the first component, and x is the tail of the stream, that's everything else. So what does map do then? Well, what we do is we apply the function to the first component of the stream, the head of the stream, and then we continue by mapping the function across the tail of the stream. So if you've written some Haskell programs before, this is basically the same idea as the map operation on lists in Haskell, except here we've defined it for the special case of streams. When streams are infinite, they don't have a base case, so we only have a case for non-empty streams. So that's how that's defined. Okay, so what's this talk actually about? Well, the talk is about answering a question, and the question is this one. How do we ensure that simple recursive equations, like what we've seen for defining a constant stream of ones and for defining the natural numbers, how do we make sure that these make sense? And by make sense, I mean that they actually produce well-defined streams. So here's a simple example to show that this is not always the case. So I'm defining a little stream called loop here, and it's polymorphic. It's a stream of any values of type A. And again, it has a nice one-line recursive definition. So what does it do? Well, loop is going to be defined to be tail of loop. So it's recursive because it's defined in terms of itself. What does the tail function do? Well, that's the built-in primitive on streams, which removes the first thing, removes the head, and gives you back everything else. It gives you back the tail of the stream. So if you take the tail of the stream of natural numbers, you would throw away the zero, and you would get back 1, 2, 3, etc. So this definition is perfectly, well, type correct, because loop is a stream, and here we're taking tail of a stream, so it's type correct, but it doesn't actually do anything. If you type this into the Glasgow Haskell compiler and you run it, as its name suggests, it will just go into an infinite loop. It will just sit there forever, applying tail of tail of tail of tail. It will never actually produce any values. So this is an example of an invalid definition of a stream. So what I want to show you in the next half an hour or so, this will be quite a short talk, is a new approach to solving this problem of deciding when is a recursive stream equation valid. I'm going to do it using two things. I'm going to do it using a representation theorem for contractive functions. And it doesn't matter if you don't have any idea what a representation theorem is, or you've never come across the idea of contractive functions, the content of this talk is to explain what this sentence means here. And I'm not going to assume that you know anything about any of these words here, or I'm only going to assume some very simple functional programming. So the starting point for the approach which I'm going to show you in this talk is the use of explicit fixed points. So many of you watching this are probably already familiar with this idea, but just in case you're not, and also to fix the notation which I'm going to be using, let me give a very simple example of this. So here's the simplest example of a recursive equation which does something interesting that I could think of. It's the infinite stream of ones, which we saw a few minutes ago. So it's recursive because we're defining the stream of ones to be a single one followed by another stream of ones. What we can do, however, is rewrite this in an alternative way. And this is a very standard idea in programming languages. So we can take this recursive definition and define what's called a fixed point operator. So what does this do? Well, fix is a function, and it takes another function as an argument, and it applies that function to fix of f. So it's a little recursive definition. In fact, it's the kind of simplest or canonical example of recursion which you can have. If you unwind this, what does fix of f do? Well, fix of f is f applied to itself, so that's f applied to fix of f, and you just go round and round and round, and fix of f is f, applied to f, etc. So it just iterates the function f an infinite number of times. So it's the simplest or canonical pattern of recursion. So if we define a fixed point operator like this, What it allows us to do is to rewrite our recursive definition for an infinite stream of ones in a non-recursive manner. So how do we do this? Well, we define ones to be fixed of a non-recursive function called body. And what does body do? Well, body takes an existing stream x's and it puts a single one on the front. So it captures the essential kind of recursive step in this function here, or essentially the essential non-recursive step. The essential thing which this is doing every time around the recursive loop is putting a single one onto the start of something. That's what the body function does. So notice that there's no recursion here. All the recursion is over in the fixed point operator. It's very easy to convince yourself that these two programs do the same thing, because what is fixed do? It iterates a function and applies it an infinite number of times. So in this case, the function is body, and that simply puts a single one on the start of a stream. So if we iterate that an infinite number of times, we will produce an infinite stream of ones. So these are two equivalent ways of writing the same thing. For the rest of the talk now, we won't write recursive stream equations in this form. We will always write them using this little fixed point operator. And that's entirely equivalent to writing them using recursion. So at this point now, we can start to be a bit more precise about the problem that we are trying to solve. So the problem is this one. Suppose that we are given a function on streams. So we're given a function f, which has type, it takes a stream of A to a stream of A. The question then is, when does fix of f make sense as a stream? Okay, so when does it make sense? When does it actually produce a well-defined stream? And we know that this is not always the case. So if we just go back to one of our little examples, if we define loop to be tail of loop, that's equivalent to defining loop to be fix of tail. And that's invalid, okay? Because we know that this is invalid. So it doesn't always make sense to define a stream using this fixed point operator. So what we'd like to find then is conditions on the function f that make this work, so that guarantee that we will always produce a well-defined stream. Okay, so the approach which I'm going to take to this problem is to use an idea from topology, which is the mathematical study of different kind of geometric spaces. And one of the central ideas in topology is the notion of a function being contractive. Okay, this is a very general notion, usually defined on some kind of metric space, but you don't need to know any topology here, because what we've done is we've instantiated the general notion of contractivity from topology down to the special case of streams. And then it becomes very simple. So here's the notion of contractivity for functions on streams. It says, if I have two streams which are equal for their first n elements, so here's a little piece of notation here, which I'm going to use throughout the talk. If I write equal subscript n, that means two streams are equal for their first n elements. For example, if n is 10, it must be equal for the first 10 elements. So contractivity says, if I have two streams with this property, then it must be the case that if I apply the function to both of the streams, so apply f to x's and f to y's, then it must be equal for one further element. Okay, so this is exactly what's captured in the bubble seven here. So this is a really important point, so let me say it again. Contractivity says, if two streams are equal for their first n elements, and I apply my function to them, then the resulting streams must be equal for one further element. So this notion of contractivity, we're going to refer to it quite a few times. So let me write it up at the top here so we can see it. So if x's equals y's, then f of x's equals n plus 1 f of y's. That's the notion of contractivity for functions on streams. What's the point of contractivity? Well, the point is a very famous fixed point theorem due to Stefan Banach in 1922. So it's almost 100 years old, it's 90 or so years old now. This is actually one of the most famous fixed point theorems in mathematics. If you take this theorem and instantiate it down to the special case of streams and contractive functions on streams, this is what you get. So what Banach's theorem says is that every contractive function on streams, and here I'm introducing another little piece of notation. When I have a contractive function, I will put a little subscript c on the function space. So this indicates that the function f is a contractive function from streams of A to streams of A. So given such a function, Banach's theorem says it has a unique fixed point. So what does unique mean? Well, it means it has a fixed point, so one exists, and it means that there is only one fixed point. So there's precisely one fixed point. So this is going to be our test, or our means, of deciding if a stream equation makes sense. If the underlying function that determines that stream equation is contractive, then we know it's got a unique fixed point, and we will say then that that stream is well defined. At this point, you have a little eureka moment. You have a light bulb that goes off, or at least we did when we thought about this. This theorem provides a semantic means of ensuring that stream definitions are valid. Okay, what does this mean? Well, if we now want to know if a stream definition is valid, all we need to do is look at the underlying function and check, is it contractive? And then Banach's 90-year-old theorem tells us that that will then correspond to a valid definition of a stream because it has a unique fixed point. So, let's have a couple of examples of this. So, a simple one first, the function 1 followed by. So this is using kind of Pascal notation. This is the function that takes a stream and puts a single 1 on the front of it. So I pronounce that as 1 followed by. It's very easy to see that this is contractive. So what do we need to check? Well, we take this property up here and we plug in 1 followed by for f and see what we get. So what we get is if two streams are equal for their first n elements, then it must be the case that if we put a single 1 on the first stream and a single 1 on the second stream, then they are then equal for n plus 1 elements. So why is that the case? Well, if I know my streams are equal for n elements, then x's and y's, of course, remain equal for n elements, and if I put the same value on the front, that will then be equal for n plus 1. So we have a trivial little argument that 1 followed by is contractive. So what we can then conclude from that is, by Banach's theorem, it has a unique fixed point, and hence, this is now a valid definition for the infinite stream of 1s. Another example is the function tail. So the function tail turns out to not be contractive. So let's convince ourselves of this. And again, all we need to do is we take the general definition of contractivity up here and we plug in the tail function for f and see if it's true, which it turns out not to be. So contractivity says if I have two streams which are equal for n elements, then their tails must be equal for n plus 1 elements. And this is simply not true in general. So for example, if we took n to be 10 here, so that means that the two streams are equal for the first 10 elements, if we remove the first element using tail, then they're equal for 9 elements, but they need not be equal for 11. There's no reason why if we have a stream equal for 10 elements and we take the first element away, they should then be equal for 11, because those streams can do anything they like beyond position 10. So in general, this property here is not true. Hence, Banach's theorem does not apply, and we will reject loop equals fixed of tail as being an invalid definition for a stream. So now we have a semantic reason for rejecting that definition as being invalid, and this corresponds to the fact that when you run this, this doesn't actually produce a well-defined stream. So now we have some questions which naturally arise. So the first one is that now we have a sound method of deciding whether a recursive stream equation is valid. We check, is the underlying function contractive? We can ask the dual question, is this method complete? or does every function with the unique point, fixed point, have the contractivity property? Well, the answer is no, and I'll give you a simple counterexample to this, which is quite interesting. Here's a function, f of x's. I'll write it down and then explain the notation. So here's a little function on streams. What does it do? Well, it takes in a stream, and then I'm using a piece of Haskell notation here. This is indexing into a stream. So it's indexing at position 1, where we start from 0. So this is selecting the second element of the stream. Then we put a 0, and then we put the stream itself. If you think for a moment, you can convince yourself that this function has a unique fixed point. It's given by the constant stream of zeros. That's the only function, which is a fixed point to this function. But you can check that this function is not contractive. Okay? You can find a counterexample to this property here. In fact, what we'll see in the remainder of the talk is a very simple method for looking at functions like this and knowing that they are contractive or that they're not contractive immediately. Okay? Once you see the rest of the talk, you can look at a function like this and observe immediately that it's not contractive. So then we have another couple of questions. What does contractivity actually mean? So this property up here is something which I first came across around about 10 years ago. I think it was my colleague Ralph Hinzer in Oxford who first showed me this. And I found this very interesting, but I had no intuition at all for what it actually meant. It's a very simple property, it's just a few symbols, a simple implication, but what does it mean? What's really captured in this property? Or, you could then ask a more general question, what kind of functions are actually contractive? Maybe it's a very small class, and actually not very useful, but actually it turns out you can precisely characterize the class of functions that are contractive, and they turn out to be very simple, but very general. And that's the main technical result, which I'm going to show you in the rest of the talk, and then show you kind of some practical applications of this technical result. So the key idea to this is, let's view a stream as a time-varying value. So this is a very natural idea. So suppose we have some value x, which is varying over time. And time here is the natural numbers. We're counting from 0, 1, 2, 3, etc. So here's the value of x at time 0. Here's the value of x at time 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, so this is a very standard idea in kind of stream programming. Think of a stream as a time-varying value. If we do this, it turns out that contractivity corresponds to a very simple but very nice temporal property. And it's this one here. A function is contractive if and only if its output value at any point in time only depends on input values at strictly earlier times. Okay, so what does this mean? So if this is our output stream, for example, it means that the output at time 2 can only depend on the input at times 0 and 1. Those are the earlier times. It cannot depend at the input at the current time or the input at any future times. It can only look back in time. Similarly, if we're considering the output at time 1, this can only depend on the input at time 0. It's one step back in time. And then the input at time 0, that can only depend on, can only depend on inputs at earlier times, strictly earlier times, and there's no earlier times, so this can't depend on anything. So you can see immediately from this property down here that the first value output by a contractive function must always be a constant because it cannot depend on any earlier inputs because there is none. Okay, so the key idea here is that a contractive function is one who has the simple temporal property that the output value at any point in time only depends on input values at strictly earlier times. Then you have another one of these eureka moments, these light bulb moments. There's three of these in this talk. This is the second one. This result simplifies the process of deciding if a function is contractive. And it does that because We no longer need now, once we've proven this result, to check this property up here. All we need to do is check a simple temporal property. Is it the case that the output at every point in time only depends on strictly earlier inputs? Okay, so we have this kind of eureka moment. So let's have a few examples of this. Let's start with a couple of simple ones and then go back to one which I had on the board a moment ago. So the first example is the one followed by function. So remember, what this does is takes a stream and puts a 1 on the front. So let's consider the output value. So the first output value at time 0 is 1. That doesn't depend on anything. Each subsequent value is the previous input value. Okay, so the output value at time 1 will be the input at time 0, the output at time 2 will be the input at time 1, and so on. So if you think about this temporally, this is a one-step delay function. Okay, the output at each point of time only depends on the input at one step earlier in time. Okay, so it's a one-step delay. This is fine. In contrast, the tail function is not fine. It's almost dual to one followed by, in a certain sense. So what does tail do? So tail takes the stream and removes the first value and gives you back everything else. So the output at time 0 will be the input at time 1. The output at time 2 will be the input at time... output at time 1, sorry, will be the input at time 2, and so on. It's actually a one-step look ahead. So with tail, each output depends on the input one step later in time. So this violates the temporal property that we have for contractivity. So this function here is not contractive. So let's do one more example now. And it's the little function which I just had. So f of x's equals x's index 1 followed by a 0 followed by x's. So we had this example a few minutes ago as a function which has a unique fixed point but is not contractive. And how do we know it's not contractive? Well, we could prove it or disprove it using this property, but it's now very easy to tell immediately, just from looking at it, that this function is not contractive, because here is the output at time 0 and it depends on the input at time 1. So already, at time step 0 here, it's looking ahead one step in time in the input, so we know it violates the simple temporal property, and therefore it is not contractive. Oops. So how do we formalize this idea now? Well, we formalized it using something that we call generating functions. And the term generating functions is very overloaded in mathematics. We're not implying some kind of connection with something which you may already know is a generating function here. It just turns out to be an appropriate word to use for reasons that we'll see in a bit. So we're going to formalize this temporal idea using generating functions. And for us, these are going to be total functions that map finite lists to single values. So we can capture this with a simple type. Here, we're going to use square brackets in the Haskell sense, but here we mean finite lists, and here we're going to single values. So here we have a finite list of values of type A and a single value of type B. And the intuition here is that this is going to be an input history. It's all the earlier inputs that have already been seen by a contractive function. Okay? So a generating function maps finite lists to single values, and the intuition is that the input list is all the earlier input values of a contractive function, and the single value of type B is the next output value. So for example, if this list had 2 values in it, then we would produce the third output. If this had 1 value in it, we would produce the second output. If it had no values in it, we would produce the first output. Okay, so the output is always kind of one step ahead of the input. Okay, that's the idea of a generating function. This leads us now to the main technical result in our work, which is a representation here. So there's 3 parts to this, and they're all very simple, so let me talk you through the parts. The first part is that every contractive function can be represented by a generating function. So what does this actually mean? Well, it means that given the space of contractive functions, so here's contractive functions from streams of type A to streams of type B, and notice here that I don't need to restrict the A's and B's to be the same, because we're not taking fixed points at this juncture. All we're doing is considering some function spaces. So here's the space of all the contractive functions. What I can do is define a little representation function which shows how to translate every contractive function into a corresponding generating function. And I won't give you the details of this function here, but you can see it in the paper. This is just a little functional program, and in fact you can type it in and run it. It's a constructive definition. The second component of this result is the vice versa part here, and this says that we can map in the opposite direction. So given a generating function, so that's something that takes an input history and produces the next output of the contractive function, we can generate, and that's why we call these generating functions, we can generate the corresponding contractive function on streams. And again, the details of this function are in the paper, and again, it's just a simple functional program which you can type in and run. It's a constructive definition. The last part of the representation theorem is that these two functions form an isomorphism. Okay, what does that mean? Well, we're actually just working with sets here and functions, so it means that these two sets are in bijective correspondence. They're in one-to-one correspondence. So what does that mean? Well, it means if I have any contractive function and I map it across to a generating function and then I map it back, I will always get back where I started. And correspondingly, if I start with a generating function and I map it across to a contractive function and I map it back across, I will always get back to where I started. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between this large function space and this smaller or simpler function space. So this gives us a representation theorem because it says that every contractive function can be uniquely represented by a generating function. So this gives us our third and final eureka moment in the talk, and it's that this theorem provides a practical means of producing streams that are well defined. So why is that the case? Well, previously, if we wanted to produce a well-defined stream, what we needed to do is define a function, check if it's contractive, which is this property up here, and in general that may involve some quite significant amounts of work, maybe even some theorem proving or an inductive proof. Now we don't need to do that because we know that all the functions in here are in one-to-one correspondence with functions over here. So what we can do is just program over here, which is in some sense a simpler function space. We don't need to check for contractivity over here, we just need to check, do we have a total function which maps on finite lists? And if you use an advanced language like Agda, for example, it can check totality for you automatically, and you can define in a precise way a type of finite lists. So if you use a good programming language, there's nothing actually to check over here. The programming language itself will make sure that you only write total functions on finite sequences. Once we have one of these, we can then map it back across using this generating function, and then we will get a function which is guaranteed to be contractive, and then we can take its unique fixed point. So this gives us, in some sense, a simpler but equally powerful way of defining streams. Okay? We don't anymore need to check for contractivity. We just program with these simpler generating functions, map them back across, we're guaranteed to get contractivity, and then we take a unique fixed point. So let's have a few examples of this. So here's our first example, the infinite stream of ones. So let's see how we can define this using a generating function. So I'm defining a generating function called g, and it takes as its input history natural numbers, and it's going to give back a single natural number. So we're actually going to retire a recursive not with this function, so this isn't really an input history, this is the output history of the function. So this is all the previous outputs which have been produced, and then this is the next one. So then we have two cases. Note that this function is not recursive. The first case says, if we have not produced any output so far, then we produce a 1. And that corresponds to the fact that the first output in the infinite sequence of 1s is a single 1. That's captured precisely here. We haven't produced any output, so we've got an output history which is empty, we just output a 1. And then the other case says if we have produced some values, so this is our output history, it's a finite list, x will be the most recent output, so I've stored them in reverse time order here, so we don't have to scan down to the end of the list. If x is the most recent output, and x is all the earlier outputs, what do we do? Well, the next output will just be the same as the last one. So this captures the sense in which you can produce the natural numbers using, the infinite stream of ones using a little machine. The starting case is you produce a one, and the step case is that you just copy the last thing that you did. So that's the generator for ones. How do we produce a stream then? Well, we just follow the little picture here. We've got a generating function, we produce a contractive function, and then we take its unique fixed point. So that's captured with the little definition here. Here we're defining ones to be a stream of natural numbers. We take our generating function, we translate it into a corresponding contractive function, which is guaranteed to be contractive by our theorem. We take its unique fixed point, which is guaranteed to exist by Banach's theorem, and then we're done. Okay, so we have a simple generator, and we're guaranteed to get a well-defined stream. Here's another example. Here's how we can produce the natural numbers in a similar manner. So we define a little generating function, and again, the output history is just a finite list of natural numbers, and then we produce the next one. So how do we produce the natural numbers? Well, the first natural number is 0, and then the next natural number is whatever the last output was, plus 1. Okay, so again, important point here, this little function is not recursive, it just captures the kind of base case and the step case for producing natural numbers. And again, we guarantee to get a well-defined definition when we put everything together. We take our little generating function, produce a contractive function, and then take its unique fixed point, and we're done. There's nothing to check. We don't need to check for contractivity anymore because we get it for free by the way that we have constructed our stream. So here's the last example I want to show you, and this is the well-known Fibonacci sequence. So let me remind you of this sequence. It starts with 0 and 1. That's how it gets going. And then all you do to produce subsequent values is add the last two values. So if we add the 0 and 1, we get 1. And then if we add the last two values, if we add the 1 and the 1, we get 2, 3, 5, etc. Okay, so how do we express this using generating functions? Well, we produce a 0, then we produce a 1. So when we produce one value already, the next value is a 1. And then if we've already produced two or more values, we just add the last two. And so I think this gives you a very nice, compact, and very easy to understand definition for how you produce the stream of Fibonacci numbers. It corresponds exactly, in a very compact way, to this description up here. If you produce nothing, you start by producing a 0. If you produce one output, the next one is a 1. If you produce two or more, you just add the last two. Okay, and we're guaranteed to get a well-defined stream, which will be the stream of the Fibonacci numbers. Okay, so that's all I really want to say. There's many more technical details in the paper, but I didn't want to go into these in the talk. I just wanted to kind of sell you the basic ideas, and if you're interested, you can find out more details in the paper. So let me summarize what we have done. What we have done is shown that generating functions are a sound and complete representation of contractive functions. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between kind of large space of contractive functions and the simpler space of generating functions. What this gives us is a precise characterization of the class of functions that are contractive. In particular, there are those that have the simple temporal property that the output value at any point in time only depends on input values at strictly earlier times. It's a very simple property. What this provides us is a simple but rather general means of producing well-defined streams. Okay, and we've seen a few examples of that in the talk. There are some more examples in the paper as well. There's lots of interesting things that you can do further, and we have done some of these already. and I'll just talk you through some of these. When we first started this work, what we actually wanted to do was find a representation theorem for contractive functions on arbitrary co-inductive types, or a large class of co-inductive types, of which streams are just one example. That turned out to be much harder than we thought, so we specialised down to the special case of streams and worked out all the details, and we thought it was a nice story. It's a nice simple story, which is accessible to basically anyone with some basic functional programming knowledge, so we wrote the paper on which this talk is based. But what we would really like to do now, one of the things we'd really like to do now, is generalise to arbitrary co-inductive types, or if you put a categorical hat on, arbitrary final co-algebras. So that's an interesting topic to do. Something else we're very interested in is other kinds of generating functions. So the generating functions that we have at the moment are only allowed to look back in time. They can't look at the current time, and they can't look forward in time. But many streams can be defined, in a good way, using functions which look at the current time, or even look forward in time. So let's give an example of this again. So I should have left this up on the board, because we've had it three times now. Here's a little function. So this was our example of a function which is not contractive, because it's looking one step ahead in time in the input, but it does have a unique fixed point. So how can we make sense of something like this? Well, an interesting observation is that even though this is not contractive, its composition with itself is. Okay, that's very easy to show. And this corresponds to the fact that this looks only one step ahead in time, and here we've composed one extra copy of the function with itself. And it's very easy to convince yourself that if a function looks kind of n steps ahead in time, you do an n-fold composition of the function with itself, and that function turns out to be contractive. So we haven't worked out all the details of this yet, but we think basically that we can also deal with functions that look ahead in a sensible way by having this kind of iterated function composition. And the number of iterations tells you how many steps you need to look ahead. So that's something interesting to study. Something in which I haven't said anything about is the relationship to other techniques. If you're familiar with programming with streams, there's many other ideas which maybe are kind of ringing a bell in your head at the moment. Things like the worker wrapper transformation, which I've written a few papers on. Things like syntactic guardedness, Peter Hancock's notion of eating, Ralph Hinze's notion of unique fixed points. This technique is clearly related to many other things, and it would be interesting to explore the relationships and the relative expressive powers and benefits and disadvantages and so on. The last thing I want to comment on is about efficiency. I didn't say anything about efficiency in the talk, but there is an efficiency issue with these new definitions. So if you think about Fibonacci numbers, so here's the generating function. You produce a 0 and then a 1, and then you add the last two numbers together. I was careful here, in all of these examples, to store the input history in reverse time order. So the most recent values are at the start of the list, and the oldest values, the earlier values, are at the end. And this was a good thing to do, because all the three examples I had always looked at the most recent values to produce the next output. But in general, that need not be the case. There could be other examples where you need to look quite far back in time, or completely back in time, to produce your next output value. So this particular representation of the history may lead to bad time performance for some examples. This program here also has poor space performance. And you can see that because if you think about the pattern here, all we need to produce the next Fibonacci number is at most two previous values. Okay? But you're still maintaining the entire input history in this function here. So this is everything. This could contain hundreds of thousands of values here, and you don't care about these. All you ever need is the last two. So potentially, there is, or in reality, there is a space problem with these kinds of definitions. But we figured out how to solve this, and the details are in the paper. It's a little bit more technical, so I didn't want to present it in the talk, but all the details are in the paper. So we have a very general, but very principled way of improving the efficiency of these definitions And it's actually using another representation theorem for our contractive functions. And I won't go into the details, but let me just show you the type. So let me define a type of trees. So I'm defining tree of AB to be this. So I'm defining a type of infinite trees, because this is a chordated type, so it's infinite trees of A's and B's, and we have nodes with B's in the nodes, and then we have A branching subtrees. So this is the type of infinite trees, or infinite A branching trees, with B values in the nodes. And it turns out that this type here is isomorphic, or in bijective correspondence, to the space of contractive functions from A's to B's, and therefore bijective or isomorphic to generating functions. And it also turns out that this type is the key to having a principled approach to improving the space and time efficiency of these definitions. And again, you can read all the details in the paper. So that's all I want to say. That's the end of the talk. Hope you've enjoyed it. If you do want to find out a bit more, you can recover the slides, and also there's a kind of 25-page research paper which you can get from my webpage. If you just do a Google search for my name, you can find everything there. So, hope you enjoyed the talk. Thanks for listening.